When I was about in the 10th grade, I think it was, in high school, couldn't have been more than that, one day after school, I wandered out with everybody else, and, you know, all chaos breaks out when it's time to get out of school, and especially even at high school, you're making your connections with friends and all that kind of thing. Well, there was the word there was going to be a fight, and when that goes out, well, you gather because you want to see the fight. And my mother always said that my mouth could write more checks than my backside could cash. You know what I mean? I'm an instigator. I was an instigator in those days, and I felt that, well, the two protagonists, maybe I could say a word to encourage this along. And so I was just giving my input. You're going to take that from him? You can't believe what he just said about you, and just instigating, you know. Well, lo and behold, one of the combatants looked over at me and rethought his position. Why am I fighting this other guy? Here's a likely candidate right here. And I think I can take him. So there, the circle reformed around us. And I got to tell you, that was not the way I had thought it was going to go. You're talking about bad timing. That was a bad time to have been an instigator, for now the anger is directed in my direction, and I think I'm in for a serious whipping. But speaking of timing, about that time, my mother walked into the circle and took me by the arm and led me away and said, "Don't you know that they're all going to jump on you?" Now, this was in the 60s, the early 60s, so you can imagine what it would have been like today. But in those days, there was still a measure of respect for an older person. My mother was not ancient at that time. I can't remember how old she might have been, but nobody said a word to her. Nobody insisted that they were going to have their way. And it was a matter of perfect timing that she would have walked in at that point. The reason she was there was that on the grounds of where my high school existed were two other schools. One was an elementary school where my younger sister was attending, and the other school was a middle school or a junior high school where my older sister was attending. So she had come to pick up my youngest sister and happened to be there at that time. That's timing. And you know, I didn't even get ribbed about that later on, about mama's boy or anything like that. They just had a high regard that she had the nerve to walk into a circle of an impending combat zone and take her son off like she did. I'm grateful for that timing. The first time in the scriptures that the Creator is revealed to us with his prevalent aspect of timeliness by name is in the book of Exodus. If you'll turn with me to Exodus, the 3rd chapter. Because today I want to talk to you a little bit about timing and the fact that the God we worship is an on-time God. I'm grateful, of course, that my mother saved me from some bruises and some scars and maybe being knifed. They weren't carrying guns in those days, but they sure carried a bunch of knives in the Detroit area. Her timing was impeccable, as it was on many occasions. But here in the 3rd chapter of Exodus, we find something about our Creator that I want to share with you, this aspect of his timing. And it's revealed by his name. In Exodus, the 3rd chapter, in verse 13, we know the scenario here. We know the story of what God was doing, how his calling of Moses at this point was to empower him to go to the children of Israel with a mission. And of course, as one is wont to do, you raise the objections. If someone comes to you as a salesperson to sell you something, and they have to anticipate what your objections might be to purchasing what they are selling. In this case, Moses' objection was that, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and require that he let your people go? So God responds to him in an interesting way. Moses said to God in verse 13, "Behold, I'm going to the sons of Israel. And I shall say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you." Now, they may say to me in response to that, "What is his name?" and what shall I say to them? And God said to Moses, here's what you say to them, I am who I am. And he said, thus you will say to the sons of Israel, I am has sent me to you. But in the revelation of this name, and we have all the controversy about sacred names that stem out of this passage, the YHVH, how it's pronounced, what vowels should go in, and all of that kind of thing. But more importantly, the meaning that comes out of this passage is what's significant. Because in revealing this name, Yahweh, Yahweh, Jehovah, Jehovah, whatever you choose, it reveals an aspect of God's timeliness, the fact that he is an on-time God. And so in this name, he tells Moses and reassures him in the following verse 15. Furthermore, he said to Moses, thus you shall say to the sons of Israel, the Eternal, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, has sent me to you. This is my name forever, and this is my memorial name to all generations. I'm reading from the New American Standard Translation. It's interesting, don't you think, that in revealing himself to Moses on this occasion, it was a timely thing. Well, think about it for a moment. How timely was it from a human perspective? How many people had died in slavery among the Israelites? Quite a few. Generations had gone by without intervention on the part of God. There was an amount of things they had to endure before God felt it was now time to intervene. And that's a difficult thing when we look at it in real time, and the times in which we live, let's say for now, with things as they are in the world. We see the generating circumstances in every aspect of life all around us, and we feel it is now time for God to intervene in the affairs of men and return Jesus Christ to the earth. I'm sure the ancient people felt that God should have intervened sooner in the matter of the Israelites who were encapsulated in slavery in Egypt. But let's think a moment about this thing of timeliness, and that God, from Genesis 1 until we are introduced to Moses, we see God's impeccable timing. Before we ever find out there is a Moses, we see something about his impeccable timing. For instance, in the garden with Adam and Eve. Now, you think that timeliness would have been to intervene before they ate the fruit. Wouldn't that be timely? To prevent the chaos and the tragedy of being put out of the garden, to begin a life of sin and difficulty and being ostracized from the presence of God? Wouldn't that have been more timely? And yet, God in his timeliness allowed that to happen and then showed up, when you read the account, after everything has happened, and asked Adam, where are you? Where are you, Adam? That whole story tells something of God's timing, because he showed up at the right time. But it's hard, isn't it, for us to appreciate that it was the right time? Because from a human perspective, we don't want to suffer. We don't want to endure pain and difficulty. We don't want to be on the outs with God. And yet Adam and Eve suffered the ultimate ostracism, put out of the garden in God's perfect timing. What about Cain and Abel? When you think about timeliness, wouldn't it have been more timely for God to have stopped Abel from casting the stone against his brother's skull and killing him? But he didn't. He only showed up after and asked the question, where is your brother? Timeliness. That's an aspect that sometimes we get out of focus, because in our perspective of time, when we want God to intervene, when we want his intervention, is from our perspective, but from his, as we examine these accounts, we find a different sort of timing. In the case of Enoch, when his life was threatened, he certainly showed up on time there, didn't he? When he hid Enoch from those who would have taken his life. And it seems to me that when we examine the issue of timeliness on the part of God, in the case of Enoch is a perfect example where we find him mentioned in the book of Hebrews for his faithfulness to God, it seems that God will sometimes intervene when there is no possibility of us working it out for ourselves, or when something is going awry, in the case of the whole world going its evil way, and God intervened with a man named Noah and told him to build an ark, and that the ark would be inhabited by not only the animals but by his family. Eight souls, the Bible tells us, were saved by God in a timely fashion. Then if we examine the issue of Nimrod at the Tower of Babel, what about that one? Was that timely or not, when the humanity got together to construct some kind of idea of maybe achieving some entree into the presence of God by this great tower? It was a place of worship, to be sure. It unified the people in a project, and all of a sudden God intervenes, confounds their language, scatters them throughout the earth in a very timely fashion. If we look at the life of Abraham, plenty of times God was on time with him. With the promise of Isaac, he was on time. I mean, think about it for a moment. How old was he when Isaac was born? About 99, 100, somewhere in there. His wife was 90. That doesn't seem timely according to what we know of the human existence. And yet God was on time with that promise. But then requiring Abraham to take this son up to a mountain and to sacrifice him didn't seem to fit in a timely fashion. And yet, just as he was on the downstroke with the knife to destroy his son, God stepped in on time. My mother taught me, and she said this frequently, God always has a ram in the bush. And that's what was prevalent and available to Abraham in the case of the sacrifice he ultimately made. It was not his son Isaac, but the ram in the bush. God has this impeccable timing. And timing is everything. Let us consider the timing of this on-time God that we're talking about today. It's my intent that we apply the lessons to ourselves as we see the scriptural examples. Some believe God's timing is a little off, perhaps it's one of his bad aspects about himself, that his timing is a little off when one of his created beings, Lucifer, went bad, went south, went sour, and headed away from God's presence with a third of the angels or the messengers of God. Some suggest the ever-living one is in a desperate struggle to try to catch up and to gain the upper hand again. And those who conclude such things are unaware of timing. And when you apply this to our lives with the conditions that we each face, whether it's a financial concern, whether it's a health concern, or whether it's how we can accomplish the work set before us, we are sometimes concerned about timing, about how things should go. Well, let me suggest to you several scriptures that we want to look at today to discover and to assure ourselves that our God is always on time. Turn with me to Daniel, the sixth chapter. We know a lot about the prophecies of Daniel, and from a youth, some of us have been taught the stories of Daniel and the Hebrew boys and so forth. But I want us to emphasize the story from the point of view of God being on time. In the sixth chapter of Daniel, and I'm going to be working backwards towards the front of the book, but in the sixth chapter of Daniel, we're told about Darius the Mede and how he organized the kingdom of the Medes and the Persians after he had conquered the Babylonians and had destroyed Belshazzar, as Daniel had prophesied according to the word of God. We now have Darius the king, the Mede, in control, and he establishes 120 princes over the kingdom. And he has three commissioners that he instructs to be over the management of the kingdom, and one of them is Daniel. Sometimes we are puzzled about whether or not a person could be ever involved in politics. I don't know how political you can get when you're Daniel, the Hebrew lad who is going to be the ruler of the Babylonian kingdom for a while under Nebuchadnezzar, and then now under Darius. This is a new transition that happens here. The Babylonians have been conquered, and now the Medes and the Persians come in, and they find something significant in Daniel. So maybe when we consider Joseph being the leader of Egypt under the Pharaoh, that there might be a place for somebody in government. Maybe. I don't know that they could be voted in, but perhaps an appointment would be the best way to do it, so you don't have all of the baggage that goes along with it. But yes, Daniel had control. In fact, he was so good at his job among the three commissioners that he exceeded them all. He excelled them, which sets up a natural inclination towards jealousy, right? People are a little upset that Daniel, this Hebrew, and you want to talk about racism and ethnicity problems that exist today. Well, they existed then. Get the picture. Here's this Jewish lad, this Hebrew lad, Daniel, who had been buddy-buddies with Nebuchadnezzar, a Babylonian, who now has been conquered by these Medes and the Persians, and in a concoction of a cosmopolitan development within that ancient world, you would have a natural inclination towards people being a bit upset about somebody's ethnicity. How is it that Daniel should be ruler over us? He's not one of us. He's not one of our kind. He doesn't look like us. He's not from our stock. I hear that he only eats vegetables. In fact, I hear that he observes the Sabbath and all of those strange holy days. He doesn't even worship our God. And so they set out on a mission. They got the king all convinced that he should concoct a rule and a regulation requiring that nobody should pray to any other god but the god of the Medes and the Persians. And so that was set up. We won't read all the verses, but verse 10. When Daniel knew that the document was signed, this regulation that had been signed by King Darius, he entered into his house knowing full well of this regulation. Now in his roof chamber he had windows open towards Jerusalem, and he continued kneeling on his knees three times a day, praying and giving thanks before his God as he had been doing previously. So instead of being intimidated by those who would lie in wait for him, who would construct a means by which he could be destroyed, he continued to do the right thing. And he prayed. Then these men came by agreement and found, this is agreement is the word they use in this translation. This is the perfect time to use conspiracy. Because they had conspired to do away with Daniel, and they would do away with it by using the laws and the regulations within the realm. They knew they had the king in a tenuous spot. And they came and found Daniel making petition and supplication before his God. Then they approached and spoke to the king about the king's injunction. Did you not sign? Is it not a law? Aren't you constrained to respond to such a thing? That any man who makes a petition to any god or man besides you, O king, for 30 days is to be cast into the lion's den. And we all know the rest of the story. The king could only answer, of course, he was concerned about Daniel. But they responded and said, this is a true statement, and this is a law of the Medes and the Persians. This is like what Pharaoh said in the Ten Commandments, so let it be written, so let it be done. The only thing that would change the course of this event of Daniel not being cast into the lion's den would be that the king could rise up and say, well, I changed my mind. But apparently he couldn't do that, lest there be a rebellion in the ranks. And so he had to unwittingly agree to what had to be done. In verse 15, then these men came by agreement to the king and said to the king, recognize, O king, that this is the law of the Medes and the Persian, and has no injunction or statute which the king established can be changed. It cannot be changed as a result of your changing of mind until those 30 days have expired, and this Daniel has been found guilty. The king gave his orders in verse 16, and brought Daniel and cast him into the lion's den. And the king spoke and said to Daniel, your God, whom you constantly serve, will himself deliver you. Well, now, when will he do that? Sometimes when we think of a story like this, the intervention should come before you're in the danger. Wouldn't you think that would be the best way? Before you're near bankruptcy? Before cancer has invaded your body? Before the marriage is dissolved? Before all of that? But yet, Daniel, as you know, is cast into the lion's den. In fact, it's sealed up and signed with the signet of the king, as well as the signature of all of the other princes who were there. And the king went to his palace in verse 18, spent the night fasting, and no entertainment was brought before him, and his sleep fled from him. And in a hurry the next day, he went to examine what might remain of Daniel. And he cries out to him. The king spoke to Daniel in verse 20, Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you constantly serve, been able to deliver you from the lions? That's an interesting question, don't you think? Because many times we have an opportunity to witness to our belief, witness to our living God. And I don't know if we often take advantage of it. I mean, look at all that we've been through in the past year. Isn't it a perfect time for us to establish that we serve the true and living God? Isn't it time that that be recognized? Rather than question or to wonder within ourselves of the timeliness of God and his presence in what we do. Here's what happens in this situation. Daniel was not going to give up on God. He had the experience of praying to God on many occasions. 3 times a day was his tradition. And in this circumstance, God intervenes on time in the lion's den with every possible thing that could go wrong. Hungry lions, right? Daniel, you don't belong in this place. You're talking about bias and prejudice. Lions are kind of biased and prejudiced against invaders into their lair, wouldn't you think? So what would they do normally? Well, they would have torn him asunder, eaten him alive, or at least eaten him in death. And here's what Daniel says in verse 22. My God sent his angel and shut the lions' mouths, and they have not harmed me, inasmuch as I was found innocent before him, and also toward you, O king, I have committed no crime. Now, the encouragement that comes out of this passage, and I hope that we will be enamored with it, is that God intervened in a situation that seemed so spectacular, but he was doing this constantly in the lives of his people. We could find other examples of God's intervention and his timing. I mean, think about Samson for a moment. Blinded, abused, embarrassed, had turned from God, had been tricked by his wife Delilah, and there he was grinding away, doing that day after day, and recognizing that he had made a mistake, that he had sinned, and reestablished a connection with God to show how God's timing is so impeccable, he goes into this temple situation to be ridiculed by the masses of people, where all of the high honchos have gathered to put down Samson. And what happens? Timeliness. Even though it cost Samson his life, the last thing that those folk remember was a bunch of rocks falling on top of them because of God's intervention in such a timely fashion at a feast where everybody's gathered. Timeliness of God, it's amazing. And so in Daniel's circumstance, it not only had an impact on his life personally, but an impact on the people around him. Look at what Darius writes in verse 25. To all the people and nations and men of every language who were living in all of the land, may your peace abound. I make a decree that in all the dominion of my kingdom, men are to fear and tremble before the God of Daniel. Just take Daniel's name out. Take Daniel's name out and put your name there. Is it possible that you could say or influence and have an impact on the communities in which you live that such a decree could go forth? Is this just a story? Is this just an isolated event? Or can we go through the scriptures and see constantly this revelation of God using situations, circumstances, and people to declare that He is God, and He alone is God? It goes on to say, "For He is the living God and enduring forever, and His kingdom is one which will not be destroyed, and His dominion will be forever." This is a testimony from King Darius. He delivers and rescues and performs signs and wonders in heaven and on earth, who has also delivered Daniel from the power of the lions. I don't know what opportunities present themselves to you to be a witness and to have experienced the intervention of God in such a timely fashion to where what you say, what you have done, will have an impact in a larger audience than just with yourself. Such a day is prophesied, is it not? In the book of Matthew, chapter 24, we talk about it all the time. The things that Christ said would happen to His people, that you might be brought before kings and rulers and judges to give an account for what you believe and what you are all about, you and I. Well, there were three boys in the third chapter of Daniel, and you know that story about the fiery furnace and how it came about that, again, jealous folk with every intent to bring down the morale and bring down the importance of these three Hebrew boys, Hananiah, Azariah, and Mishael. We know them as I was taught, it was Shadrach, Meshach, and the big Negro. Abednego, excuse me. I'm sorry. But that's the way I used to be taught about those guys. And anyhow, they were friends with Daniel. They had been one of the crowd that came in the captivity. And of course, they were significant young men, and they were part of the rulership with Daniel under the kingship of Nebuchadnezzar. Now we're backing up to the Babylonian Empire now, from the Medes and the Persians. And so there was jealousy among everybody around that these guys were being favored by Nebuchadnezzar and so forth. So the conspirators came up with an idea. We'll erect this statue. And Nebuchadnezzar was all down for that because, you see, he was a vain individual himself. And, yeah, let's erect a statue. And while it doesn't specifically say it was of himself, but who else would it have been of, you know? I'm the King Honcho here. So we've got this statue of Nebuchadnezzar. And they require that every time you hear these instruments played, you should bow down and worship this idol. Well, that was anathema to the children of Israel, those who were going to comply with the commandment that says you shall not worship any other gods, you should have no other gods before you, and so forth. And so Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego did not respond as they should. They remained standing. And now the conspirators come and tell Nebuchadnezzar what's going on in chapter 3 and verse 13. Nebuchadnezzar is enraged and angry. He gave orders to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Then these men were brought before the king. Nebuchadnezzar responded and said, "Is it not true?" "It's true, isn't it, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you don't serve my gods or worship the golden image that I have set up. Now, if you're ready, at the moment you hear the sound, I'm going to give you another chance." Now, some would say this is the perfect time for you to swallow your pride and say, "Well, in order to save my life, I think I will bow down, though I won't mean it. I will do it just to spare my life because my life is at stake right here. But if you won't worship," it says, "you will immediately be cast into the midst of the furnace of blazing fire, and what God is there who can deliver you out of my hands?" Now, timing gets to be important. Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego answered and said to the king, "Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to give you an answer concerning this. We don't have to think about it. We don't have to deliberate on it. We don't have to analyze it. If it be so," verse 17, "our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the furnace, because our God is an on-time God. He's able to intervene even in such a situation as a blazing fire. What kind of blazing fires exist within our lives today? Flames licking at our heels. What kind that we could isolate and analyze? He goes on to say, the boys go on to say, "And he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But even if he does not," that's a twist, because they are saying that God's timing is impeccable and he may decide not to intervene. In fact, he may allow us to die. "Let it be known to you, O king, if that be the case, that we are not going to serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up." And you know the rest of the story. They were cast into the furnace, and Nebuchadnezzar was so upset by their statement and their posturing in his view that he said, "Let's increase the heat in this furnace. In fact, I want you to get some strong soldiers to carry them to the furnace mouth and throw them in. And when these strong men of war and valor got close enough, they died and were consumed by the fire, and the boys went into the furnace." Verse 23, "But these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell into the midst of the furnace of blazing fire, still tied up. Nebuchadnezzar the king was astounded and stood up in haste. He responded and said to his high officials, 'Was it not three men we cast bound into the midst of the fire?' And they answered and said to him, 'Certainly, O king.' And he answered and said, 'Look to this on-time God. Look and see four men loosed and walking about in the midst of the fire without harm. And the appearance of the fourth is like the son of the gods,'" is this translation. The King James has it, "the son of God." And further down in this passage, we understand it to be an angel. Some descriptive form about it declared that to be so. Nebuchadnezzar came near to the door of the furnace of blazing fire. He responded and said, "Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, come out, you servants of the Most High God, and come here." And they came out. And all of the princes and the prefects and the governors and the king's high officials gathered around and saw in regard to these men that the fire had no effect on the bodies of these men, nor was their hair on their head singed, nor were their trousers damaged, nor had the smell of fire come upon them. It's hard for us sometimes to contemplate that God is that timely, that he can extract us from a furnace of burning fire, or that he could stop the mouth of lions. But that's the witness that we observe here. Nebuchadnezzar was so impressed. In verse 28, he said, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angels and delivered his servants who put their trust in him. Violating the king's command and yielding up their bodies so as not to serve or worship any god except their own God, therefore I make a decree that any people, nation, or tongue that speaks anything offensive against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be torn limb from limb and their houses reduced to a rubbish heap, inasmuch as there is no other God who is able to deliver in this way." Sometimes I think we read these stories and think, that was then, this is now. God isn't that concerned about us, about intervening on our behalf in the circumstances in which we find ourselves. But that is not true, brethren. It is not true, for back in Exodus, the third chapter, I'm going to pass over the other story I was going to take out of Daniel, the dealing with the Hebrew boys in Daniel in the second chapter, dealing with the vision and showing how God stepped in on time to give Daniel the vision to Nebuchadnezzar so that he could explain what it was all about and brought Daniel and the three Hebrew boys into prominence and to rulership within that empire. But I want to go back to Exodus, the third chapter, to look at a couple of points here that deal with this issue of God's timeliness, his perfect timing. As I said in the beginning, when you think about the children of Israel being in bondage for 400 years, that's a long time. A long, long time. Many folk speak of the the bondage in which the African Americans or the Africans who were brought into slavery and servitude in this country, they speak of having been in this country for 400 years in some form or another, going back to 1619, somewhere around in there. That's not quite 400 years, but you hear all kinds of figures that speak of that. Well, the Israelites were in Egypt a long time. And when the Pharaoh died who knew Joseph, and a new Pharaoh came into prominence as this book describes for us, we are captivated by the fact that God set his will to intervene on their behalf. Verse 9 of Exodus, the third chapter, which describes the timeliness of God, where it says, "And now behold, the cry of the sons of Israel have come to me. Furthermore, I have seen the oppression with which the Egyptians are oppressing them." Now, for those who were experiencing the trouble, they may have felt that God has forsaken us, that God is not concerned about us, and that God has turned his back on us. But this description to Moses by God is that, yes, the cry of the sons have come to me. Kind of reminds you of back in Genesis, the sixth chapter, right? When God tells Noah, "Yeah, I've seen some terrible things in the earth, and it's now time for me to intervene. And I'm going to destroy all life off of the earth and just preserve for me you, Noah, and your family." Timeliness. Very confusing to us in our human minds many times. But back over in the second chapter, in verses 23 through 25, we find these words. "Now it came about in the course of those many days that the king of Egypt died, and the sons of Israel sighed because of the bondage, and they cried out. And their cry for help because of their bondage rose up to God. So God heard their groaning. God remembered his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And God saw the sons of Israel, and God took notice of them." How does one apply these passages and gain instruction and inspiration that God, who sits high and looks low, is aware of what we experience on a daily basis and where we are in the scheme of things, where we are in the scenario of fulfilled prophecy, and where we are in the task that is set before us? We should gain inspiration from the fact that God is an on-time God. Too many examples exist in the Scriptures. If you were to think about Elijah showing up at the house of this widow and her son with just a cruse of oil and a little meal left for some food, you would say, from a long-distance view, God was on time. She was able to eat after her son died. Elijah brings him back to life through the power of God. God was on time. One of the worst bits of timing, you might say, would have been in the first century when the disciples, especially Peter, says, Oh no, Jesus Christ of Nazareth, you cannot leave us. You can't go. Philip says, "Where are you going? And will you show us the way?" Because it was at that point in time, in the timing of God, that it was required that a Savior die. And we are horrified at the methodology of the death. And many people are still angry with the Jews because of something that had to be in God's perfect timing. Why would we be upset with the Jews? Because in the crowd were all of us saying, "Give us Barabbas." Timing is very important in the plan of God. And God's timing, again, is impeccable. It's perfect. And the fact that Christ would die on the Passover, perfect timing. That he would be resurrected in a perfect fashion on a Sabbath. A day of rejoicing, the true day of resurrection. And all of the timing of God throughout his holy days and his Sabbaths are there for us to be inspired by, thereby, And yet, sometimes we are perplexed and we wonder and we agonize, even in the death of a loved one. As Mr. Armstrong and others mentioned at the funeral last week of Norma Davis, Psalm 116 and verse 15, I believe, precious in the eyes of God is the death of his saints. And yet we would think the timing is not perfect. It's not like we want it. And yet God knows best. And we have to take assurance in that fact in our lives. Turn with me to Romans, the 8th chapter. Romans 8. Paul was one who certainly recognized the timing of God. How better could God's timing be? Here you are, you've just stood around, you know, consenting to the death of Stephen, holding the coats of the young men who have stoned him to death in the streets of Jerusalem. And now you've gone to the high priest and gotten letters of accommodation to go and take prisoners in Damascus and bring them back to the high priest. Perfect timing for a young man named Saul. Yet, you're on the road to Damascus, and in God's perfect timing, you are knocked off of your horse, you are converted to this way of life that you hated, and become a soldier in the army of God. I'd like to get a witness from a man like that. And we are fortunate to have his words recorded for us. And so in the 8th chapter, this very important chapter of the Bible, in verse 18, see what it says here. For I consider, this is Paul speaking to the Roman church, I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory that is to be revealed to us. I know that we can get a witness from Daniel and the Hebrew boys and Noah and all of those people that we have become familiar with in the scriptures. I know we could get a witness from them, but what I want to know today is, can I get a witness from you and me to the timeliness of God? Is there something that we can despair of and should despair of? Paul goes on to say, for the anxious longing of the creation waits eagerly for the revealing of the sons of God. Everything around us is waiting for some kind of intervention from God Almighty and for the revelation of those children of God whom we claim to be. And that revelation does not just simply exist when the last trump sounds. But prior to, people need to know who we are. For the creation was subject to futility, not of its own will, but because of him who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself also will be set free from the slavery of corruption into the freedom of the glory of the children of God. For we know that the whole creation groans and suffers the pains of childbirth together until now. And not only this, but also we ourselves, having the first fruits of the Spirit, even we ourselves groan within ourselves, waiting eagerly for our adoption or sonship as sons, the redemption of our bodies. And what do we do until God decides it's time to send Christ back to the earth? What do we do? What should we be involved in? Well, many of you here are employed directly in the front line of what we as a church and as a mission are doing into the world. And those who will hear this tape and view it at some future time, we must be stimulated by the fact that it's time for the children of God to manifest themselves to the world without embarrassment, without apology, without fear, without concern that if there is a fiery furnace and if there is a lion's den and if for some reason we find ourselves engaged and in bondage in some kind of way, so what? We've been apprehensive and been shy and reticent to some degree to declare who we are. And I know that that was my case, you know, in doing this radio program. I didn't want it really known that I was a minister. I wanted to have this objectivity veil, you know, that I could be objective. Well, it just didn't happen that way. because people just know. And when I was on television a couple of times had someone mention to me that, well, we thought you did an outstanding job. They're not part of our church or anything like that. You presented the information well, and you represented the church and so forth. So now everybody knows who Bronson James is in East Texas. And you know, in God's perfect timing, it hasn't meant anything but good. Nothing but good. All of the concern about, well, they're going to think we're that little nutty group out there next to the lake. These crazy people out here. It is time to stand up and declare who we are. Are we ashamed or embarrassed? When it's time to stand in the den of lions or face the fiery furnace or whatever the encumbrance might be. In God's perfect timing, He is saying to His children, it's time. For I am going to send Jesus Christ back to this earth, but He's only going to come to receive those who are part of His flock. And I am in the assumption that that's who we are. Some people are trying to hide, and there's a methodology to hiding that's it's impeccable, really, when you get down to it. You can hide in all kinds of ways. You can say, we're not a church. That's a way of hiding, because you don't have very much expectation of anybody not a church. But we are a church. We are the assembly of God's people. And we have a mission that's set before us. And it seems like there are so few of us. Well, there are more of us out there than you would ever imagine. There were 70 people who came to a organization of a church meeting in Detroit 2 weeks ago. 70 people we didn't know were there. We have a television program there, and it's producing fruit. And one individual who I had known back in my very first days in the Worldwide Church of God came up to me. They're an older couple now, retired, Mr. and Mrs. Watson. I don't think they'll mind me mentioning their name. They are members of the United Church of God. But because they weren't having Sabbath services that week, and they had gotten a letter, they came. Because they are, and I hope I'm not speaking out of school, they are supporters of this ministry. Even though they are part of another organization. And there are thousands of people like that. We're not alone. We don't have to talk like Elijah, that God is not in a timely fashion, that I alone am left. There are others. And we need to be encouraged by that. The fact that God is on time and that He has something in store for us, yet in the future, but for us right now. This work that has been faithful for so many years with Mr. Armstrong preaching and all of us in support of that, and even Mr. Armstrong sharing the camera with myself and Van Stinson and others as the time will come along. We are all involved in a mission. And God, our God, is an on-time God. Yes, He is.